bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, and welcome to Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Brian Brushwood.
Yo, buddy, yo, buddy, yo, buddy, yo.
And Bryce, no fun.
Oh, I made him put his toys away before we started the podcast.
I found myself like I've been doing a lot of like online courses and stuff lately, and so I spent a lot of time sitting at my desk watching. And I am one of these people like I can't just sit still. And it used to be like, oh, I'd have a deck of cards or whatever like that, and I don't do that so much anymore. So it first started with like a Rubik's cube. And then it started with like a pyramid cube, and then like some crazy, the Rubik's cube that's like the three different sized shaped layers that unfolds into like a Borg ship. And so I sit there and I watch these things. I just fiddle with this. And so right before the show, like, you know, my annoying habit, you know,
I think for just be, like $20 or whatever, you could get something that'll put a little gate action on there where it sort of filters out any of the background noise.
We do some gating. What? We already.
Oh, we're already doing our best.
Yeah.
Bryce is like, don't encourage him.
we had talked off of one of the shows a few weeks ago about maybe getting some fidget cubes in here to like have something so you're not like distracted by other stuff during the shows. And so I ordered one for myself at home, and I realized, oh, we definitely can't do that because they're not silent.
Right. Like they're all meant to click and whir
some of them are not audible.
Yeah.
And so I know I've been at home the past week just with the little auto switch.
I have like these two pens, these two like Sharpie markers that I will just like fiddle with like throughout the streams, like just if I'm editing or whatever, like I just have to have a little thing that can butts with. I wonder, like, is that a sign of our modern era, or did everybody always just need to fiddle with stuff and now we just have a business around it and we're feeding it?
I think it was always there. Like, there was always that dude in debate class who could spin a pencil around his thumb and catch it, right?
Like, you knew Todd too?
Yeah, right? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a primate thing. I think it's just that, like, if we're doing work where our hands are being preoccupied, fine. But otherwise, it is that urge to explore our environment, to test things, and to sort of do things. And you see this too with other intelligent animals. Like, you know, dolphins do that. They probe things, test things around. And I mentioned this before. When I did the shark thing for Discovery Channel, like the great whites would come up and explore, like, hey, this cable holding your submersible, what's this made of? Nom, nom, nom. They're curious about stuff. And so I think it's just this wolves, dogs, you see dogs like sniff stuff around. Remember the, you know, with the Neuralink demo with the snout boops.
Oh, sure.
Know, yeah. The pig snout. Yeah. So, yeah, that just kind of shows that, yeah, intelligent animals like to probe their environment. You know, we're here, we're playing with pens.
Is like, should we feel guilty? Does it make us bored?
Yes, we should feel horrible, Brian.
I mean, with kind of the virtualization of work between like computers and keyboards and stuff, like it probably makes sense that there's like just some muscle memory, like there's it's lower activity to do your work throughout the day, and so having, I don't know, having more actions to do.
You want to know what? I guess I hadn't thought of that like. In an era where I was doing more physical things, like, you know, I just have much less tactile responsibilities. And so now maybe some of that bleeds over into
to a clicky
fidgeting
pen.
with this thing. No, I can't do the clicky pen because I just know that that'll be like, I just know that if I start screwing around with the clicky pen, then the world will know how I am unable to focus on anything.
You can't do that. That's a yellow card. What are you doing?
I pulled out this puzzle box that unfolds in like these crazy shapes. Yeah, my problem is like I'll be watching a video and then like I'll have like a cube in my hand and like I'm like, I gotta get this piece over here. Da, 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 da. And I look up, and like 3 minutes have passed. I have no idea what just happened, and I have to rewind it.
I think that I guess what we're doing is we're finding something to occupy ourselves when all we want to do is burst in and talk, but we know we must not. And so for me, the habit seems to be like an oral fixation of just constantly taking sips of whatever beverage is in front of me, which of course leads to a moment, like the moment the camera's not on me, I'm taking a sip of something. And then the moment I have the opportunity, I'm like, I'm going to go to the bathroom. And it's like, it's silly, but it gives me something to do, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, look at, remember if you watch old episodes of Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show,
those guys got to smoke.
If we didn't see, but when it became unfashionable, you would see the cigarette smoke and the higher, when you look at like on a better quality tape, you would see the cigarette smoke rising from the behind the desk
because they put camera. The ashtray.
Yeah. He'd be behind in between scenes, be puffing away and then put it there. And then sometimes you see an interview. If you look in the corner, you'd see this little smoke drifting there. Okay. Letterman with a cigar.
Yeah.
Weirdly, Larry Sanders just has a big old ashtray that so far has never been used for anything ever.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That's
the HBO sitcom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody cut their own hair?
Not yet, man. I did re-up on my minoxidil. I'm digging these lush
pill?
Locks. Yeah. Well, it's a spray, and Bonnie picks them up. It is ridiculously cheap now. So she picks them up and it's just a spray. But then only after we got it did we see it says warning, herbal blend, very pungent. And we're like, well, how bad can it? Oh, God.
It's bad enough that they have to print it on the box because they never would do it on their own.
So we immediately got some like mint flavored or whatever. So whenever I'm wearing a hat, I'm just like, all right, let's just use this stuff up and then hide it under the hat. But I think I'm gonna go all the way. I think I'm gonna come out the other side with Sawyer hair.
Now one of us is looking especially fresh today.
Oh, Andrew, yeah, you are.
Are you the one who cut their own hair?
Mm-hmm. I cut my own hair.
How'd you do it?
With scissors?
Well, I didn't know if this was a setup for
YouTube video or
I sat in a chair and it decapitated me.
My hair gets really frizzy in back, like really, really. And normally, if I could just have that trimmed, and I'd ask my girlfriend, like, oh, you cut my hair? She's like, no, I like it long. I'm like, I think you're just trying to keep me unattractive and ugly. I ordered some clippers and I had some scissors. And then I'm like, I'm just going to cut it. Like, I just need to cut it. And I looked at a YouTube video.
Watched a couple YouTube videos.
Yeah. And I went in there, watched the video. I'm like, all right, I think I got this. I went on the sides, did that. And then chim. I'm like, holy cow. Other than the back, which does not look good.
Hard to do the back. Always hard to do your
back. Yeah. Back is hard. Like, I've got an idea on how to do the back next time, though. But I'm like, this is not the worst haircut I ever had.
No, it looks pretty clean. Like, and it's a simple do, you know, gracefully. Like, it looks nice.
The last week of production on Mono Rogue, Jason walks up and says, hey, you ever have one of those moments where you're just trying to fix one little thing and you fix it and you realize, ah, I kind of overdid it. Let me fix it on the other side. And you keep on. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And then before you know it, you're like, no, I've been there. He goes, so anyway, and he pulls off his hat. And there's like a Cupid doll tuft at the top. Like, that's all that's left. And he goes, I bought 4 hats.
He grew into it. I think he figured out how to style it by the end of that shoot.
Yeah.
But it was a great story.
Like, any story that ends where the punchline is you remove your hat is chef's kiss.
Yeah, I think I might go get my hair cut by a professional.
Okay.
Because it's legal now. It's
Nancy legal Pelosi's to do. Doing it.
Nancy Pelosi was the brave freedom fighter that broke the monopoly here in Alameda and San Francisco counties. Even for the Bay Area, we are the last holdouts for everything. And that included indoor salon stuff. So Nancy Pelosi got her hair blown out. And sure enough, within 24 hours, Alameda County's like, sure, that's fine. Yeah, we could open up barbershops again. So I literally just went to my barber's website, and they have appointments now listed in their big open air. They open the front, and it would I would feel safe in terms of air circulating. It's effectively outside, so I'd be very, very happy. I'll be happy to get a professional haircut.
For mine to open, and they didn't. I'm like, fine, I'll cut it. And I cut it, and then I finished it. I'm like, I need to get some gel. I'm like, I'll go across the street, go get some gel. I go outside, I walk, I look over. Now open! I'm like, oh, jeez. It's like an O. Henry story, you know? It was just this, they're waiting for me, like, all right. Mm-hmm. Hey, gentlemen, look up in the sky.
Another roach? Oh.
I mean, it's definitely just my ceiling.
No, I see the sky.
Brian does have a skylight view, so maybe if that's Brian
that's
why. Can help you.
Would you like me to describe it? The clouds are beautiful. There's a family. They're having a birthday.
Is it still blue up there?
Yes, no, and there's so much to live for, Bryce. Don't give up. it looks like they're putting up a banner. Somebody's graduating. Remember little Timmy? I was telling you about little Timmy. He's graduating.
Oh, okay. Congrats, Timmy.
Yeah. Whatever you do, don't kill me to try to take my spot. Because
so in other news, we had a report. This was last week, which was pilot landing at LAX reports guy and jetpack fly near plane.
Oh my god! I heard this. Just casual, like, yo, bro.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, traffic control and pilots are always super calm. That's why when you see something in a movie where people like panic, like, no, that ain't real. So apparently there's a report of like, we see some guy who looks like he has a jetpack flying by us.
now we're talking about one of those simple, like, I forget which gas it is. Like, I want to say it's
swamp gas.
No. Like hydrogen dioxide or something. But basically it's just straight up air being released, like two tanks, super pressurized. And you just go up.
What are you basing this on?
The fall guy from the 1980s.
Oh, all right. No, this is 3,000 miles up. 3,000 feet up.
Okay.
3,000 miles up. Oh, God.
Yeah, good God.
3,000 feet up.
It was Elon Musk in there.
It was 3,000 feet up.
Wow. So, I did see this headline when it came in, and they didn't find anybody, right? There's no suspect, right?
No. They, but I have one for you.
It's the Rocketeer.
I made a dumb tweet about, like, you know, Tony Stark unavailable for comment. I got picked up by one of these sort of like smaller news sites and stuff. I'm like, reactions include, it wasn't that good of a joke. But here, I'm going to send you something, Bryce, because I'm going to show you something brought up something, that might be kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, that's like, imagine being the pilot that has to report that. Like, man, like, there's the joke that, like, you know, they tell you got to report to, you know, the flight supervisor's office, and they're like, yeah, bring your flight certificate and a lighter. Yeah, the idea is that they're gonna burn it up.
Okay, so we've got this video here. You want to take a look at it?
Oh my god, there's video.
No, not of that, but of a suspect.
Just of this, okay, of something.
So we see Jetman Dubai take off.
Wow.
Whoa, so he's got like wings. He's got, it's a man with like airplane wings.
It looks like that hydrogen peroxide, you know, kind of gassing, which works, of course, because, you know, it's not burning your legs off as you're flying, but with the advantage of having wings. So I guess when it runs out, you can...
It's not the peroxide thing is like 30 seconds. This is jet turbines. This is jet fuel and turbines.
What? Jet fuel?
Cow.
Yeah, no, the peroxide thing is, it's not really... That was like they'd use that for like, give you like 30 seconds of flight. This is what we've seen Jetman before, Rossi or whatever. So he's got four turbines strapped to a wing, which is loaded with fuel.
And so with the wings, it almost makes... I don't know, it kind of makes me think that he should be like in a Superman pose, you know, his back parallel to the ground.
He's standing upright right now. The wings are outright. He just floated off of like a pier and like the water near Dubai. Mm-hmm. And so now he is hovering over the water, and there's like a drone capturing this, and he's going to do a couple flights. Then it's going to get like really crazy in a minute or so. But he's got several minutes of flight time with this, which is like crazy. And then
I mean, I guess if you have a limited range of a few minutes to fly, my guess is you would want to make sure those were around an airport so that you had a place to land.
Sure. And he's doing this over the water, so, you know, and there's a safety boat there.
This is just the test flight, guys. This is just making sure everything's running right.
Oh, my gosh.
There's a lot of...
Now watch.
Oh, that's a superhero flying.
Oh, he's Supermaning
it. That's a legit superhero just flying off towards Dubai.
Holy
cow. Holy cow.
That's...
And this was February of this year. Like, this is recent.
Yeah.
I mean, this can't be far from becoming, like, the new kiteboarding, where it's like, these guys again. Like, flying around in their jetpacks.
We're seeing the whole Palm Island in Dubai.
Yeah.
He's so high up now, you can see that.
Oh, and he's doing a loop-de-loop?
Insanely high up. Like, he is, like, thousands of feet, maybe thousands of miles, if you go by my math. Now he's parachuting.
So why is he parachuting? Because he just expended all his fuel?
Bryce, so you know how to land these things? Are you the expert on this now?
Oh, yeah.
Let's say he did a VTOL on and off.
Slow down. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible.
All right, so with that visual, let's now go to the audio transcripts from this LAX thing. Pilot... Tower American 1997. We just passed a guy in a jetpack. Tower American 1997. Okay, thank you. Were they on their left side or your right side? Pilot, off to the left side, maybe 300 yards or so at our altitude. Meanwhile, the tower then goes to a Southwest flight. Southwest 6046, Southwest pilot. Tower, we just saw this guy pass by us too. The tower then goes to a JetBlue flight. And they were looking. They did not see it, but the other two independently, two pilots from an American flight and a Southwest flight both saw this man in a jetpack.
And this is where again?
LAX.
Ooh. Wow. Odds it being the same guy.
To LAX. I mean, inbound. It doesn't mean they could have been 30 miles away from LAX, but that would have been the air traffic.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I thought one of them was on the runway. Oh, maybe not.
Maybe. I don't know.
That's wild.
There was a viral video years ago, and I forget which movie it was, but it was Iron Man or something, where they took basically, they made like, it wasn't actually a drone, it was like an airplane that looked like a person and flew it around New York City.
Oh.
Which was pretty cool.
So they took like a remote controlled airplane, gussied it up to look like Iron Man and flew it around.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Iron Man, but it was something like that. And it looked cool because you look far away and you're like, oh wow, this looks cool. Oh, damn, Bryce.
I think this is flying people in New York City from 2012.
That's so dope.
And so there's a drone with a string attached.
Oh, that's so great.
Oh yeah, they're
Oh, it's so great to get old enough where I can still remember where I would think this is the greatest idea in the world, but be old enough to be legit horrified that this kind of irresponsible stuff is being done in the flight space.
Honey, it's the rapture.
Yeah.
It's a lot less people than we thought.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, is it Green Lantern or what is that?
And they're so far away. Like when you see the details on them, you can tell that they're like aerodynamic and not like full.
They're basically like very fancy kite tails that are being dangled by monofilament line behind drones or whatever.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, but they look great.
Was this viral marketing for Chronicle?
Oh, 2012.
Yeah, that would have been around the right time.
Yeah, Chronicle came out in 2012.
Chronicle NYC is the name of the YouTube account.
Good catch. Yeah. Good
I think
catch.
I remember that as part of this.
Oh, that's wild.
And no, yet, great when idea, you try though. To promote great an idea. Adult swim property, you get shut down by terrorists.
As terrorists.
As terrorists.
As terrorists.
I mean, the police. Anyway.
All right. Speaking of amazing heights, you too will reach amazing heights when you become a patron at patreon.com/weirdthings. Make sure that this show keeps on rolling each and every Tuesday. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yeah. And while you're at it, head on over to doghousesystems.com/v/rogue. They're the ones who provide all the equipment that we run on. We're still working off our debt to them, and you're going to need a new computer at some point anyway. So there.
Here's I found an article, and they show, because those were RC planes with wings, like designed to look like people.
Oh.
So they weren't drones. They weren't dangled. Those were actually the planes themselves that were doing that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You see them where they're carrying them. Yeah. Yeah. Oh wow, that's even more impressive because it's like kind of an oblong shape.
Really clever design, really really clever engineering on that. Brian's like, Marvin Rose.
I definitely am thinking like you caught me exactly in state.
Yeah, like, for audio listeners, Brian literally had his finger to his mouth doing that.
Right now, the latest thing I've been thinking about is what pirate radio station I want to run from the property so that as people approach maybe some kind of 30-minute something War of the Worlds is on a loop, whether it's a fake NPR, whether it's a, you know, a disaster fake thing or whatever. I don't know.
How about the theme to the Pirates of the Caribbean soundtrack? I mean, like the actual ride, the sound from the ride.
This Dead is the
tale.
Captain Jack Sparrow, fool of Tortuga.
That is such a great song. Oh, oh my God. Does he know the Lonely Island Michael Bolton song?
Oh,
is,
God, yeah.
You
Michael
really
Bolton
appreciate
is a major cinephile.
Yeah. Yeah, you appreciate his voice and yes, his love for movies.
Now back to the good part.
Yeah, that's so good. Jetpacks, send in. We want to know what's going on here. We're confused. This is a very cool. There was an article that came out that was on the Nature magazine website, but it wasn't actually, I think, published in Nature. It was, I think, published somewhere else, but it was mentioned there. And this was some researchers have said that, again, this will be, we'll be able to watch this, then see what the reaction is and the follow up if there's anything true to this. But the idea of how solar, the sun can influence earthquakes, and the idea of like saying that there may be an effect where like when solar winds strike the earth, it could charge tectonic plates, like vis-a-vis like the piezoelectric effect.
Oh, so we're not even talking about like the general swelling and contraction of the daily solar cycle. We're talking about like next level something.
You get some flare up of a solar wind that comes towards the earth. The paper says they found a correlation between earthquakes and solar winds. So basically, I try to find the link to this article for you, Bryce. You'll probably find it before I do. So this is a new paper that's come out, and basically on the correlation between solar activity and large earthquakes worldwide. And they say they've graphed solar activity and earthquakes and see a correlation. Now, the problem with this is that there's a lot of earthquakes all the time, earthquakes around the world. And so trying to figure out which ones were influenced by this, which ones weren't, et cetera. This paper goes deep into details. Somebody smarter than me will be able to take it apart and look at it, and I'm curious to see what the reaction is. But it's a very interesting idea, though, that it's just that this external thing that affects it. They looked at the SOHO satellite data.
That's insane. I mean, because everything that I do know about earthquakes is that there is just not a whole lot. There's certainly not a whole lot of predictive capacity to it, where if there was some other, like, hey, by the way, we might be facing some earthquake activity because of our ability to track solar winds, that'd be amazing.
I mean, I suppose conceptually, I can imagine, like, if you put your fingers together and you're about to snap, there's some you know, musculature impulse that causes you to snap the rest of the way. But if you're just poised there, I could totally see where a shock of whether it's a thermal shock or I mean, in this case, of solar wind shock would be enough to kick it off. That's something I hadn't even considered. So at this point, we're looking at just a boy. That's a curious correlation, right?
Yeah, they did a first as they looked to see if there was a correlation between, you know, we look at the SOHO satellite, which is great observer of the sun. Look at the correlation between data coming from there and earthquakes to see if they could find. And they said, look, we found a signal where there seems to be this influence. When the solar energy picks up, you start to get, you know, your earthquakes or, you know, it's tied to earthquakes. Again, like I'm not a seismologist, and I know that there's earthquakes all the time. How they're separating them from, you know, how are they differentiating them to figure out which earthquakes are which? Are they looking for certain magnitudes, whatever, or something else? But it is, and then they looked at to say, what's the mechanism? The mechanism they talked about that's been brought before is that you have, you know, the rocks, you know, that make up our crust, there's water, there's whatever, they may be affected by piezoelectric effects and electrical charges. And there could be a thing where there's a charge differential there that's causing this. And there's some people, there's claims that like you get discharges near earthquakes, where you may see like, you know, electrical discharges, et cetera. So it's a very speculative kind of like, if this is true, and if this is true, this is true. But science is about narrowing these things down by one and figuring out like, was it predictive, or are you just really good at hindcasting to figure out like, and you know, they said, you know, we were able to look at the data forward and say, look at here, but you know, will it be predictive? One, and two, does the mechanism hold up?
Can I ask a totally dumb question just so we could play with it and think if it's possible? Is it possible to build up a set of stations that essentially pay off nothing in terms of energy until an earthquake happens? And what would that look like? Because an earthquake is a release of potential energy. So if there's potential energy, just like there is potential energy in the water stored behind a dam, for all I know, Tesla has already had 5 patents on this or whatever, but is there anything to the thought of trying to prepare for the eventual release of the potential energy of an earthquake and use it to capture it in some way?
Well, you would have to figure out one. I mean, we could go to, let's say, you know, somewhere along the San Andreas Fault, where there are places in the California desert, whatever, like where, you know, this is the fault line, this is the region. And you know that when shifts happen, you're going to have that there.
Right.
To try to capture the kinetic energy from that, the problem would be you would have to think up some real exotic thing. Like, oh, like, do we know that the piezoelectric thing is effect? Is there a really big charge differential? It'd be kind of like trying to capture lightning. You know, you could do it. But and it would be this would be more math. Lightning would be even easier than this, and even that,
yeah, that
is
that's a good point. Because you're right. At least lightning happens every single day. I guess I'm thinking in terms of like some kind of giant, cartoonish network of flywheels that you know stuff happens, and then you know whatever the shift is, all the flywheels spin into motion. But I think as an engineering problem, you're right. It would be much easier to build something for lightning instead.
Yeah, and somebody says it would be kind of like trying to capture energy from the change in air pressure. Yeah, we call that wind energy.
We
just wait for the wind to want to move from here to here because there's a pressure differential, and you capture the wind as it moves by. You know, there is a, and then that's a problem with like wind energy and then like ocean turbines, like trying to capture wave, you know, tidal, like, you know, if you look up some of the stuff on like, you know, tidal energy is huge. And the problem we deal with a lot there is corrosion, is that you can build a thing, you can build a little floating buoy that sits out there and basically goes up and down and generates energy as the tides come in and they go out. A big problem is just that these things corrode so much. And when you look at when you try to figure out where you want to get your energy from, you got to do a spreadsheet and say, what does it cost to build this? What does it cost to maintain it? And those are real costs that often get left out of like, oh, we should all switch to this green thing. It's like, yes, in the imaginary world where materials never wear down, photovoltaics last forever, this makes sense. But it also shows you where to direct your energies, making photovoltaics last longer, et cetera.
I don't think I'd ever pause to imagine what a tidal dam would look like. But you're right. It would be as simple as just a tether with air up top, and then water goes up, things gets pulled, much like, you know, a rowing machine, thing goes down. But of course, our constant villain is storage. Like, we have no way to store the energy or to get anywhere.
Well, Bryce, go back. You can show, like, there are actually some real ones, some real test ones and stuff that, like, they've done. And, you know, you can run a cable, you can have a unit, like a generator below the cable pulls on, and then it just has a power cord that basically runs to, you know, the shore, and you can get your energy there. Yeah, here's a tidal wheel. So the problem here, too, is that, like, I think that they're kind of a worse solution than wind power, because wind, you know, they can interfere with sort of the migratory path of birds and stuff. Here, your effect on sea life is going to be pronounced. It really is going to be pronounced. And that's, I think that's why there's less sort of tidal energy sort of focus now, too, is because it's hard to figure out what the impact's going to be.
Am I right?
Well, and also, you can put wind in a lot of different places. As long as there is like a big open space, you can put up wind turbines, and there might be people that are upset. I don't know a lot of areas, a lot of beachfront areas that are not going to be spoken for, protected, and coveted by the people around them.
Well, remember that this would be, most areas aren't beachfront though. Like, most areas like aren't. And also, where you'd put it in places like a lot of places like Northern Europe, like, you know, the North Sea and stuff like that, they're looking at it and you wouldn't see it. So, that is a factor as why that, but there's a lot of places where you could put it where nobody would ever notice or see it. But there is that, the impact on sea life would not be insignificant.
And I guess this is why, storage problems notwithstanding, this is why we heard so much talk about the hydrogen economy, where it's like, once you get down to hydrogen, like, fuel cells are inefficient, but once you have the hydrogen, wherever it came from, it at least tends to be stable in a way the batteries or transmission lines are not.
Well, hydrogen's hard. Like, hydrogen's sort of like a dead end for the most part, because hydrogen's extremely difficult to contain. And where electrical power, you just put it through a cable, send it somewhere. And then if you need something like a car, then you put a battery in a car. When you start trying to figure out how to put hydrogen into a car and how to do all that, that's sort of like why, like, Toyota's still trying to stick to that. But, you know, other, you know, manufacturers are sort of what can also, like, hydrogen was exciting when we didn't think we were going to get battery density to where it is now.
Yeah.
But, and there might be cases for that, like, you know, like long haul trucking, or there might be an industrial sort of thing. Like, you think of, like, we forget, I mean, I forget, I mean, you may not, but like, how often we use like natural gas for things like, you know, forklifts and factories and stuff and things like that. And so it might, I could see it displacing, like, for certain kinds of areas where it's efficient to have like a big, huge container truck show up and put that in there. But for a lot of, you know.
Stuff. Yeah. I guess I'm trying to figure out, like, what autonomous something can be floating out in the ocean. Like, let's say the great Texas size trash pit or whatever. It's like, let's add more trash. It's nothing but windmills on top and, you know, some kind of buoy that charges based on the motion of the ocean. You got to turn it into something, and you can't put it into a battery because the battery can't hold on to it, but you could manufacture hydrogen, but hydrogen is notoriously hard to hold on to. I don't know.
And also, like, yeah, you're, unless you have, like, there's some interesting sort of work on, like, doing kind of cool electrolysis, like improving, like, membranes and stuff that separate water into hydrogen, oxygen and stuff. So if you had something that was sort of like an active sort of generator of that, that was using, but you're still using electricity. There's still electricity going into the cycle, which is sort of the problem where.
I mean, maybe
just a podcaster.
I know. This, look, we're all dumb. That's the conceit of the show. But it's like, man, like, I don't know, a Texas-sized photovoltaic that does nothing but you know, create buckets of hydrogen and oxygen.
I think the answer is going to be all of the above, and a lot. The more localized you can put it, too, the less you lose from that. So you know, the I think in the future, like your house, your the roof of your house will be completely covered in solar panels, right? You get the cost of that down to the same price as your roof. You're going to put solar panels, but it may not be 100% of your energy. But like here we are in California, and like, you know, we're getting told like, hey, it's 2020, and we're being told, hey, you may have to, we're going to have a blackout because we have really dumb ideas about the dangers of nuclear energy years ago. And so we don't have power plants, but we have all the sun in the world, and we've spent.
Do you think there's any way we get past our irrational fear of nuclear?
The DNC, I think, had put nuclear into their platform. I think they actually accept the. I mean, I heard that that was added to that there, and that had been one of the biggest problems was that for years, you know, when it came from a political point of view, is that you had one party that was for it and one party that was against it. And I think there's been a shift there now, which would be very helpful.
That'd be nice.
Yeah, I got to double check on that. I mean, but that would be because you know, we hear the horror stories and there's dumb things have been done and things aren't completely safe, but we've had a lot of the examples of things between Chernobyl and Fukushima. You saw part of it was that, you know, Chernobyl's, you know, the political environment, which had happened in a poorly designed reactor and one where you couldn't really criticize it. And then, you know, what's happening is that the engineering going into these things is so much better. So there's a lot more testing now in compact nuclear reactors, et cetera. So let's hope.
Plus also, like, I believe fourth or fifth generation reactors are able to use the waste from previous reactors as the fuel. So I don't know. I'm very bullish on nuclear, but.
Yeah. And it's been something that I think the first person that I remember talking about it from an environmental perspective was Ed Begley Jr.
No
he was
kidding.
He was very much on the use of that technology.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a shift in, I think, that because you start looking at what our options are. And, you know, I think it's an all the above approach. But I think that, you know, the more we go into different areas, the better. Like I said, in the future, like, you know, you'd have solar panels on your roof, you know, maybe have a nuclear plant, you know, somewhere not too far away and able to provide and switch over. And then eventually one day we go to fusion.
Yeah, so, maybe one day.
So, yeah. Hey, do you hear that?
What's that?
It sounds like singing.
Oh. Ah. Oh. It's the sound of my pick.
No, Brian.
Oh, not
it's
yet.
Not the sound of your pick.
Oh.
It's a dog that's singing. Like
a singing dog.
A singing dog. A New Guinea singing dog. But like, Andrew, they're extinct. How are we hearing the New Guinea singing dog when I know for absolutely a fact that they are extinct?
Number one, well, number gentlemen. One, watch your number one, watch your mouth, Honky.
turns out that apparently there is a breed of dogs known for its singing that they thought extinct, but now they think
we heard
captivity.
Them. It was the first sound on Ill Communication. Roar, roar, roar.
They went back and redid it, though, because they found out what the dog was saying was offensive.
Oh,
oh no.
Yeah.
All right. So here we go. A singing dog here. Let's hear.
It sounds a lot like howling.
And I will always love you. So, I don't know enough.
Come in, criticize.
I don't know the difference in the genealogies of like dogs and wolves and stuff. I assume that they are not unrelated. But I guess, I don't know. It just kind of sounds like a howling wolf.
this music critics. What can I say?
Andrew is just like, guys, we have one conceit on the show. We believe as hard as we can, as long as we can.
What I don't know is how rare it is. That's
apparently they were possibly considered extinct, and now they found some in.
Turns out they were shy.
Like-
Indonesia?
I like that Justin was expecting a new Adele album. That's what I like.
This wasn't about the quality of the music. I didn't want to be like, this isn't like, I wasn't like, oh my God, this is so terrible. Oh, a little pitchy, dog. I'm really upset with the quality of your tunes. That's not what I was saying. I just didn't know how rare this thing would be. I didn't know why, like, because you could tell me, Justin, dogs have never howled. Like, you've never heard a howling dog before. And I'd be like, sure, fine. I don't know. I never really had dogs. I don't know.
It's a boodle beagle boo.
here we are hiking through, like, the Malaysian forest. In the middle of the night, we hear this, ooh, this ethereal howl. I'm like, Justin, yeah, that. And I'm like, I think that's a singing dog. It's a wolf. Come on, Dennis.
I mean, wait, hold on. No, if we're literally trolloping through the woods and all of a sudden you heard that, you're telling me you'd be like, whoa, that's a singing dog. No, you just assume it was a wolf.
In Malaysia?
Well, I don't know where wolves live. Do they live in Malaysia?
They don't have wolves in Malaysia.
Does Malaysia have a wolf?
He's howling in Malaysian.
All right, here we go. This will be great for all of my cookies. Does Malaysia have a wolf? Here we go. All right. List of gray wolf populations by country. We're just going to search for Malaysia. No, it doesn't look like Malaysia. So there we go.
Even better. We're walking through the woods. I'm like, oh, I got a singing dog. They're like, hold on. Hold my antenna. I got to get my connection to the internet so I can see here. Malaysian wolf. No. Hold on, let me go to Wikipedia just to check.
All right. If we knew for sure that there were no wolves in Malaysia, we heard that sound. You're telling me your first thought would be singing dog and not something even more horrifying?
No, it'd be a ghost.
I'd be like, listen to that ethereal, beautiful, haunting sound. You would be ready with your pitchfork score to rate it and like,
whoa,
you know,
dad,
whoa, thumbs down.
Where did you go with that?
I mean, I don't know how close they are, but I'm thinking like Viet Cong. Like, I've already got a stick all sharpened up. I'm ready.
I've seen enough TikToks of people who are like, accidentally, my dog thought I left the house and it starts howling because it thinks no one's home. I've seen enough of those videos to go, oh, maybe someone left the house. Maybe someone left a window open.
Did somebody? All right.
Somebody
another
left
Google
Malaysia.
Search. Does anyone in Malaysia leave the house?
All right, now can we do picks?
Yes. Fine, do your picks.
I watched a little James Cameron movie by the name of Titanic.
Mm. Wait, so did you finally actually let your girls watch a girl movie for once?
Yes, insofar as watching 9/11 is a delightful girls movie. It's the 9/11 of 1912.
It's also like it's a big Titanic. Romantic movie.
It's no, it was fascinating to see how quickly they were captivated. Bonnie and Josie and I watched the whole thing. Penny kind of tapped out. She had an appointment at 1 hour, but then went back and watched it the following day. Red Letter Media has it right. It's the best and the worst movie of all time. And the parts where it's the best is very, very good. It's at the golden age of practical effects right before CGI makes it too easy to do everything. The writing is hackneyed and direct, but, is kind of great for being so. It holds up and low key, man. I need to go back and find a copy of True Lies and find a copy of The Abyss, because neither of them you can get anywhere right now. But Loki, he's might be just straight up the most feminist film director in my lifetime. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, look, it was generationally defining for people that grew up when I grew up. Like, it was the first time that I ever remember anything close to how people described Star Wars when it came out in the 70s and people just like going to the movies over and over and over and over and over again. That's what Titanic was for girls my age. Like, I it was just an immediate, flood. It was iconic, an iconic film.
I think that one of the things I loved about that was, it gets forgotten, but it's fresh in your mind, is how wonderfully Cameron did the framing devices, in that he had, it doesn't just start with, you know, Jack in the boat. It starts modern day, Bill Paxton and the whole story of the crew, you know, with the submarine, the submersible, trying to get the story. And those bookends and interstitials in the way the story is told is really brilliant. It's a sign of like how, like, you know, Cameron writes a movie so it can play in Manhattan and Manila. He writes a movie so it will play around the world and doesn't have just one audience. He has that global audience. But some of the things he did there. So if you're a dude and you're watching the kind of the cool actiony sort of stuff, you know, on board the modern day stuff, and it goes back, you're like, okay, this is cool, you know, not just a romance.
He also obeys the kind of the YouTube formula where it's like, okay, you got 5 minutes, give me something. And it better be good. And the first 5 minutes, he gives you the entire movie from a 1,000-foot tactical, why you should care about it, what's interesting about it, why it's unique. There's a MacGuffin happening. And then, you know, this old lady shows up, whatever. But then you got this curious skullduggery, you know, grave robbers that are there. And then it seduces you into actually caring about the characters and understanding, oh, wait, there's layers to social strata and all that stuff. And that happens to, and then like a thunderbolt, you're reminded, oh, wait, no, this is 9/11, the movie. It's crazy.
It's interesting too, is that before Titanic came out, I remember reading an article in Wired magazine where Cameron, they interviewed Cameron when he's in the editing room trying to put this thing together. And it had been called Cameron's Folly. Because, you know, they shot the large parts of, in Mexico, massive sets, 1/3 scale replica of the Titanic, et cetera, all of this. And on his editing bay, he had a razor blade taped to the shelf, and it said, use in case movie sucks. And people were predicting that this was going to be a flop. They were already, you know, they knew Water, you know, Ishtar, which had been a notorious flop before that. It was all of that negative sort of reaction. And then, spoiler alert.
Yeah, just iconic.
Biggest movie of all time.
Highest grossing movie.
And that was a funny when Avatar came out. You know, I remember like Justin and I were like talking, oh, well, is it going to do Titanic money? We're like, no. Like, no, it's not going to Titanic money.
I mean, part of my pitch for the kids was to put it in perspective, to shoot Titanic, he's the kind of guy that said, oh yeah, we better go out and find the Titanic. like that's how insane James Cameron is, and how worthy of watching.
Did you know you made the 9/11 reference? I think somebody told me this, that Cameron was actually in a submersible like over the Titanic when that happened.
No kidding.
I think that was he was Oof. Actually.
That would make sense. That would make sense because that was when he was in his documentary phase where he was just making underwater documentaries with the names of the movies that he has made.
Yeah. So the thing too is think about is that like with the new Avatar movies, you know, we don't have any new Star Wars films on the horizon, but we do have Avatar coming.
Yeah. Anywhere between 2 and 5 avatars at some point before the heat death of the universe.
I'll tell you what else, man. Look, we can all roll our eyes at some of the script writing that he does, but he doesn't waste any time. He keeps it simple and pulls at the right strings at the right time. I know right now Avatar is kind of an eye roller of a intellectual property for most of us, but I think Avatar fever is going to be caught whether we want it or not.
I think you would be an idiot to bet against James Cameron. Yeah. I think we can all wait until that guy actually takes an L before we start, you know, predicting that he's going to.
I worked with one of the divers I worked with, scuba divers. She had just come off the set of working on one of the, because like they're shooting the multiple sequels, working on that. And because they were doing things like training their dive, all of the actors were doing like free dives, learning how to do breath holds and do this sort of stuff. And the scope and scale of just like what it was, like hundreds of people underwater at a time doing stuff. And they've kept a pretty good lid on the production as far as what's gone on there. But they've now started putting out some shots. They show some stuff like underwater, like robot crab-like vehicles and things. And like what I've heard from just you know, getting all these top scuba instructors and divers from around the world to go be part of underwater sequences and stuff. Like, I can't even imagine what the scale of that's going to be like. I was always like, yeah, Avatar's okay, but like, I enjoyed it. But like, yeah, but then I'm like, the more I hear about this, and now that Disney needs another sci-fi property, and now they've got Avatar.
Yeah. So. We will see. Hey, I got a pick. I think it's very competently done. It's got a cast that I think is growing on me. In fact, I would say that the female lead is somebody that I think fits very, very well, almost naturally, in a hyper-realistic, magical version of Chicago. And that was no surprise when I looked up who she was, and she was Jussie Smollett's sister. And that is Lovecraft Country. I've watched, I guess, the four episodes that they have. You know, it's an interesting vibe, because I think the show itself is a little bit more pulpy and lightweight than you might expect. And yet some of the subject matter and the villains are obviously drawing on real world, very serious real world stuff. But, you know, the episode that just aired, which they have been very, very good about alternating episode by episode the kind of movie they're telling. You know, there is the cabin in the woods kind of story, and then there's the cultist story, then there's the haunted house story, and this one that just aired was far more action adventure-y. You know, we'll see where they go, but so far I am enjoying it. Lovecraft Country.
Yeah, this week was definitely a national the words national treasure came to my mind many times.
I mean, it was out and out, you know, national treasure in Indiana Jones. You know, and I think that's there's some of it as we get more and more into the mythology that you're like, is this Harry Potter where all the classes are African American studies? Like, because there's a little bit of that, but then again, I don't know if I hate that. I think I actually kind of I don't mind it. It is jarring though when they go from like there are moments that are like, okay, this is a horror show that kind of has a little bit of a sense of humor to itself, but also we are talking about very real, very dark elements of America's past. And you know, so far it is an interesting stew that I am enjoying, but it certainly is it certainly bounces all over the place. And I do like the cast. I think the cast is very good.
Cast is amazing. Yeah. There's a character that you lose from the cast who I hope comes back as a force ghost or something, because he was quite good.
Yeah. I've got a pick. Rediscovered this, I guess, over the weekend, and now I'm going to be playing this for a little while on the Twitch stream that I do on Friday nights, and that is the 2016 video game Hitman.
Oh wow!
They rebooted Hitman back in 2016 with a sort of different sort of design. So this only has 5 levels in Hitman, but there are these huge layered levels. So, you know, the first one is like in this mansion, and you have to take down this powerful couple, and one of them is running this fashion show, and the other one is upstairs running this illegal information, or this big information auction. And so you have to find your way in and take them out. And I think what's really interesting is that, like, you could just, like, you could, they have, like, pre-scripted stuff in the game. So, like, oh, you know, this one guy, he really wants this certain cocktail. So you just find the recipe and you put poison inside of it, and then, bam, you did it. Hooray. But what's really interesting is they're so intricate of levels that not only are there, like, tons of different ways to accomplish your goals with those story things, but they have, like, escalation contracts. So they say, hey, find this NPC, like they name an NPC and you see him on the map, find this person and get rid of them. And then you do the, so what you do that, okay, that's pretty easy. The next time you do it, okay, well, now there are more security cameras, or you're not allowed to vault over anything or jump off of anything. Oh, now you have to use the special disguise. You have to use a specific weapon. And I think it's a sign of like how really well made and well thought out this game is, because you can like play it very action-y if you wanted to. But I like puzzle games, but it's very puzzle like in its way of presenting you these challenges and saying, well, how could I do that? Like, yeah, I could go around and get all these different disguises, but how would I actually solve this if I couldn't change my disguise?
I mean, it's Edge of Tomorrow, the video game, right? Where it's sure. just like you your job is to listen and pay attention and know the entire story and figure out the slightest nudge that will result in the target being killed.
Yeah. And then our friend Jeff from the Rage Select podcast, he loves the Hitman series, and he always talks about like how great the story is. And it's so weird because I think most people don't get the story out of Hitman, because you play, because a lot of people will just play the level and then move on to the next one. But they even hide the story bits in playing the game multiple times. So, oh, well, you need to hear this conversation between these people, and then you need to hear this conversation between these people before you're like, oh, I actually get a sense of who these characters are and what they did and what their motivations are. And so I think it's really cool. I'm playing it on Friday Night Bryce here on the Twitch channel, and going through trying to get all of those challenges, because it truly is like a lot of fun to just have a list of like, okay, now do a chandelier kill. Now do... you know, an explosives kill. Oh,
and
get the fireworks.
I suppose some of the challenges, just by the nature of their names, you're like, what? How could you? Well, maybe if I, you know, like, mm-hmm. yeah, you start to think through that kind
of
stuff.
They're pretty good about making most of that stuff pretty upfront. You know, like, hey, in one run, get both of them with the piano wire, or you know, figure out a way to push this one person onto the other person. They don't hide what you have, that what you need to do, but figuring out how to do it is a lot of the fun. The other fun thing about it is that they made a sequel 2 years ago, Hitman 2, they actually reported all of the episodes from Hitman 1 into Hitman 2. So that's how I'm playing it, as I bought them all on the PlayStation.
Oh, cool.
And so you can all just launch it from Hitman 2. And so they've got Hitman 3 coming out in January, I think. And they're going to do the same thing again. And they're going to like keep your progression stuff. So that's kind of why I restarted it, is that I not played too much of it. And now all this stuff is going to carry forward into the new consoles. And it's really smart. I think there are not any other games doing this at this level of kind of treating it as a platform. So, yeah, Hitman.
Smart idea.
I played Hitman Go on the iPhone for like hours on hours. It was just simplified, and they did a Lara Croft like Tomb Raider, which was a simplified version of that with, you know, the tile based sort of approach. It was fun, you know.
Yeah.
You know. My pick is a geeky kind of pick, but I spent the weekend going back and doing some tutorials and stuff because I wanted to learn how to do a new framework called PyTorch, which is for like machine learning and stuff using Python. One of the things that struck me is that the tools keep getting better for learning how to do stuff. And there was a thing called a Jupyter, J-U-P-Y-T-E-R, which is a notebook. If you ever do any kind of programming, you know, either you kind of go into an interface and you write a big file that's like a text file, whatever, and you say, this is my program. A notebook allows you to sort of do, and it's kind of a form of a REPL, but we don't need to get into what that is. But allows you to say, hey, write like plain English. Here's a block. This is going to do this. Then you put a little code block. And then you could run that code block, and then you could explain it, and then you could write another code block and run that block within it. So it's a notebook that allows you to run code within kind of it's like a document where you could run things. So if you wanted to build, let's say, an image classifier, you could type in there like, oh, go to Bing and grab, you know, 100 photos of Captain Kirk and grab 100 photos of Captain Picard, put them into folders, and then you go in the next thing like, this is how we're going to tell the difference, et cetera. And you could build a document that's actually able to do computations and kind of cool stuff. And the point I was going to get to is that when I first started learning this stuff, you had to install it on your own computer. You had to figure out how to install the different drivers and all that other stuff, which was a pain because you'd find out like, oh, this conflicts with this and this doesn't work and this doesn't do that. Now we've entered this age of they have online notebooks, and Google has one called, there's Binder, and there's Google has Colab, which is, there's a free version of that where it's this notebook and you can go in there and say, I'm going to do Python and do Python programming in there and go run it. And it's, they have a version that's completely free. And it's a much easier way to learn stuff, because sometimes we want to go learn how to code or do things like this. They're like, okay, step one, block aside 2 hours because we're going to have to install some stuff on your computer. I'm like, oh no, this conflicts with your driver. Now you got to reinstall your, you know, whatever. And that gets very, very frustrating. So you can do a lot more code development, a lot more stuff online using things like Colab. And there's other companies that have different versions of that. And the advantage is, too, if your computer is slow, it's from years ago, it doesn't matter because it uses an online server. And there are some companies where you can say, oh, I want to plug this into a big cluster or whatever, and I want to use a lot more computing power. And it is, I love it because it's democratizing. You could be sitting there with a very old computer system. You can use one of these online notebooks and using an online computer to power it. And there's just so much cool kind of stuff out there that makes it a lot easier to learn these things. So I highly recommend checking out Udemy, YouTube, other sorts of courses, because the barrier of entry just got a lot lower.
Nice.
Nice. Awesome.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.